decided that his status was below what he deserved, and that you would rather have him as a friend than a slave. I jumped for joy when I read your letter. Thank you. Tyro appears almost to play the role of a surrogate son, around whom the sometimes dysfunctional family could happily unite. But even so, there is a lingering ambivalence, and Tyro's servitude was never wholly forgotten. Years after his grant of freedom, Quintus wrote to Tyro to complain that, once again, no letter had arrived from him. "I've given you a good thrashing, or at least a silent ticking off in my head," as Quintus puts it. A harmless bit of banter? A bad joke? Or a clear hint that in Quintus's imagination, Tyro would always remain someone you could think of thrashing? Towards a new history of emperors. Tyro long outlived his master. Cicero, as we shall see, came to a gory end in December 43 BCE, as did his brother Quintus. Tyro lived on, so it was said, until 4 BCE, when he died at the age of 99. He had spent the intervening years fostering and controlling Cicero's memory, helping to edit the correspondence and speeches and writing his biography, which, although it has not survived, became a standard source of information for later Roman historians. He even issued a large collection of his jokes. One of Cicero's later admirers suggested that his reputation for wit might have been better had Tyro only been a little more selective. Tyro also lived to see a new permanent regime of one-man rule, emperors firmly installed on the throne of Rome and the old republic an increasingly distant memory. This new regime is the theme of the last four chapters of SPQR, which explore the period of just over 250 years from the assassination of Caesar in 44 BCE to the early 3rd century CE, more specifically to the particular turning point in 212 CE, when the emperor Caracalla gave Roman citizenship to every free inhabitant of the empire. It is a very different story from that of the first 700 or so years we have explored so far. Roman history in this later period is in some ways much more familiar than anything earlier. It was during these centuries that most of those famous ancient landmarks still standing in the city of Rome were constructed, from the Colosseum, erected as a place of popular entertainment in the 70s CE, to the Pantheon, Temple of All Gods, built 50 years later under the Emperor Hadrian, and the only ancient temple that we can still walk into in more or less its original state. It was saved by its conversion into a Christian church without wholesale rebuilding. Even in the Roman Forum, the centre of the old city where the big political battles of the Roman Republic took place, most of what we now see above ground was built under the emperors, not in the age of the Gracchi or Sulla or Cicero. Overall, there is much more evidence for the world of the first 2 centuries CE, even if no other individual ever stands out in quite such vivid detail as Cicero. That is not to do with the survival of vast new quantities of literature, poetry or history, though there are certainly volumes of that, and of increasingly varied types. We still have gossipy biographies of individual emperors, cynical satires from the pens of Juvenal and others, pouring scorn on Roman prejudices, and extravagantly inventive novels, including the notorious Satyricon written by Gaius Petronius Arbiter, a one-time friend and later victim of the Emperor Nero, and filmed 2,000 years later by Federico Fellini. This is a bawdy story of a group of rogues travelling round southern Italy, featuring orgies, cheap lodging houses with beds crawling with bugs, and a memorable portrait and parody of a rich and vulgar ex-slave, Trimalchio, who almost gave his name to a much later classic novel. The working title of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was Trimalchio at West Egg. The dramatic change is rather in documents inscribed on stone. We have already analysed a few of these from centuries earlier, whether the tombstone of Scipio Barbatus or the semi-comprehensible inscription mentioning the king, Rex, dug up in the forum. But in those early periods, they were relatively few in number, from the 1st century CE, for reasons that no one has ever really fathomed, there was an explosion of writing on stone and bronze. In particular, thousands and thousands of epitaphs survived from right across the empire, commemorating relatively ordinary people, or at least those with enough spare cash to commission some permanent memorial for themselves, however humble. They sometimes refer to little more than the occupation of the dead. Pearl seller, fishmonger, midwife, or baker, sometimes to a whole life story. One peculiarly loquacious stone commemorates a woman with white skin, lovely eyes, and small nipples who was the centre of a ménage à trois that split up after her death. There are also thousands of short biographies of leading citizens carved into the plinths of their statues all over the Roman world, and letters from emperors or decrees of the Senate proudly displayed in far-flung communities of the empire. If the job of the historian of early Rome is to squeeze every single piece of surviving evidence for all it can tell us, by the 1st century CE, the question is how to select the pieces of evidence that tell us the most. An even bigger difference, however, in reconstructing this part of the story of Rome is that we must now largely do without the luxury or constraint of chronology. That is partly because of the geographical spread of the Roman world. There is no single narrative that links, in any useful or revealing way, the story of Roman Britain with the story of Roman Africa. There are numerous micro-stories and different histories of different regions, which do not necessarily fit together and which, retold one by one, would make a decidedly unilluminating book. But it is also because, after the establishment of one-man rule at the end of the 1st century BCE, for more than 200 years, there is no significant history of change at Rome. Autocracy represented, in a sense, an end of history. Of course, there were all kind of events, battles, assassinations, political standoffs, new initiatives and inventions, and the participants would have had all kinds of exciting stories to tell and disputes to argue. But unlike the story of the development of the Republic and the growth of imperial power, which revolutionized almost every aspect of the world of Rome, there was no fundamental change in the structure of Roman politics, empire or society, between the end of the 1st century BCE and the end of the 2nd century CE. So we shall start by looking in the next chapter at how, after the assassination of Julius Caesar, the Emperor Augustus managed to establish one-man rule as a permanent fixture, perhaps the most important revolution in the story of Rome, and then explore the structures, problems and tensions that both underpin and undermine that system for the next two centuries. The varied cast of characters will include dissident senators, the drunken clients of Roman bars, and persecuted and, for the Romans troublesome, Christians. The big question is, how can we best understand the world of the Roman Empire under an emperor? Chapter 9. The Transformations of Augustus. Caesar's Heir. Cicero may well have been sitting in the Senate on the Ides of March 44 BCE when Caesar was assassinated, an eyewitness to a messy and almost bungled murder. A gang of 20 or so senators crowded round Caesar on the pretext of handing him a petition. One backbencher gave the cue for the attack by kneeling at the dictator's feet and pulling on his toga. The assassins were not very accurate in their aim, or perhaps they were terrified into clumsiness. One of the first strikes with the dagger missed entirely and gave Caesar the chance to fight back with the only weapon he had to hand, his sharp pen. According to the earliest account to survive, by Nicholas of Damascus, a Greek historian from Syria, writing 50 years later, but likely drawing on eyewitness descriptions, several assassins were caught in friendly fire, Gaius Cassius Longinus lunged at Caesar, but ended up gashing Brutus. Another blow missed its target and landed in a comrade's thigh. As he fell, Caesar cried out in Greek to Brutus, "You too, child," which was either a threat, "I'll get you, boy," or a poignant regret for the disloyalty of a young friend, "You too, my child?" Or even, as some suspicious contemporaries imagined, a final revelation that Brutus was in fact his victim's natural son, and that this was not merely assassination, but patricide. The famous Latin phrase, et tu, Brute, you too, Brutus, is an invention of Shakespeare's. The watching senators took to their heels. If Cicero was there, he was presumably no braver than the rest, but any quick escape was blocked by a crowd of thousands who were at that moment pouring out of the theatre of Pompey next door after a gladiatorial show. When these people got wind of what had happened, they too wanted to make for the safety of home as quickly as they could, despite Brutus's trying to assure them that there was no need to worry and that it was good news, not bad. The confusion only got worse when Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, one of Caesar's close colleagues, left the forum to muster some soldiers stationed just outside the city, almost bumping into a group of assassins coming from the other direction to announce their victorious deed, closely followed in turn by three slaves carrying Caesar's body on a litter back to his house. It was an awkward job with only three of them, and reports were that the dictator's wounded arms dangled gruesomely over the sides. That evening, Cicero met Brutus and some of his fellow liberators on the Capitoline Hill, where they had installed themselves. He had not been part of the plot, but some said that Brutus had called out Cicero's name as he plunged his knife into Caesar, and in any case, as an elder statesman, he was likely to be a useful figurehead to have on board in the aftermath. Cicero's advice was clear. They should summon the Senate to meet on the Capitoline straight away, but they dithered and left the initiative to Caesar's followers, who soon exploited the popular mood, which was certainly not behind the killers, despite Cicero's later fantasies that most ordinary Romans in the end believed that the tyrant had to go. The majority still preferred the reforms of Caesar, the support for the poor, the overseas settlements, and the occasional cash handouts, to fine-sounding ideas of liberty, which might amount to not much more than an alibi for elite self-interest, and the continued exploitation of the underclass, as those at the sharp end of Brutus's exactions in Cyprus could well have observed. A few days later, Antony staged a startling funeral for Caesar, including a wax model suspended above the corpse, intended to make it easier for the audience to see all the wounds he had received, and where. A riot broke out, ending with the body being given an impromptu cremation in the forum, the fuel partly provided by wooden benches from nearby law courts, partly by the clothes that the musicians tore off themselves and threw into the flames, and partly by the jewels and their children's junior togas that women heaped on top. There were, at least to start with, no reprisals. Brutus and Cassius thought it safer to leave the city after the demonstrations at the funeral, but they were not deprived of their political offices. Both were praetors. Brutus was even allowed, as praetor, to sponsor a festival in absentia, but the Caesarians quickly replaced the play he had intended to present, on the first Brutus and the expulsion of the Tarquins, by one on a less topical theme from Greek mythology. Following a proposal by Cicero, the Senate had earlier agreed that all Caesar's decisions should be ratified in return for an amnesty for the assassins. It may well have been a fragile truce, but for the moment further violence had been avoided. That changed when Caesar's appointed heir arrived in Rome in April 44 BCE from the other side of the Adriatic, where he had been involved in the preparations for an invasion of Parthia. Whatever the rumours and allegations, and whatever the status of the little boy whom Cleopatra had pointedly named Caesarion, Caesar had recognised no legitimate children. So he had taken the unusual step of adopting his great-nephew in his will, making him his son and the main beneficiary of his fortune. Gaius Octavius was then only 18 years old, and soon started capitalizing on the famous name that came with his adoption by calling himself Gaius Julius Caesar. Though to his enemies, as to most modern writers wanting to avoid confusion, he was known as Octavianus, or Octavian. That is, the ex-Octavius. It was not a name he ever used himself. Why Caesar favoured this young man will always be a mystery. But Octavian certainly had an interest in ensuring that the murderers of the man, who was now officially his father, did not get off scot-free, and that no one among his many possible rivals, principally Mark Antony, should step into the dead dictator's shoes. Caesar was Octavian's passport to power, and after a compliant Senate formally decided in January 42 BCE that Caesar had become a god, Octavian was soon trumpeting his new title and status. Son of a god. More than a decade of civil war followed. Octavian, or Augustus, as he was officially known after 27 BCE, a made-up title meaning something close to revered one, dominated Roman political life for more than 50 years until his death in 14 CE. Going far beyond the precedent set by Pompey and by Caesar, he was the first Roman emperor to last the course and the longest-serving ruler in the whole of Roman history, outstripping even the mythical Numa and Servius Tullius. As Augustus, he transformed the structures of Roman politics and the army, the government of the empire, the appearance of the city of Rome, and the underlying sense of what Roman power, culture, and identity were all about. In the process of taking and holding power, Augustus also transformed himself in a staggering shift from brutal warlord and insurgent to responsible elder statesman, signalled by his astute change of name. His early record as Octavian was a mixture of sadism, scandal, and illegality. He fought his way into Roman politics in 44 BCE using a private army and tactics that were not far short of a coup. He went on to be jointly responsible for a ghastly pogrom on the model of Sulla's proscriptions and, if Roman tradition is to be believed, to have plenty of blood, literally, on his hands. One lurid tale claims that he personally tore out the eyes of a senior official whom he suspected of plotting against him. Only a little less shocking to Roman sensibilities was the story of how he casually impersonated the god Apollo at a lavish banquet and fancy dress party, held while the rest of the population was close to starving because of the deprivations of civil war. How he left all this behind to become the founding father of a new regime and, in the eyes of many, the model emperor and the benchmark against which his successors were often judged, was a question that many observant Romans came to ask. And historians have puzzled and disagreed ever since, both about his radical transformation and about the nature of the regime he established and the basis of his power and authority. How did he do it? The face of civil war. By the end of 43 BCE, in little more than 18 months after Octavian's arrival in Italy, the politics of Rome had been turned upside down. Brutus and Cassius had been allocated provinces in the east and left Italy. Octavian and Antony had come to blows in a series of military engagements in northern Italy and then patched things up again by forming with Lepidus a triumvirate for establishing government. This was a formal five-year agreement that gave each of the three men, triumviri, power equal to consuls, their pick of what provinces they wanted, and control over elections. Rome was in the control of a junta. And Cicero was dead. He had made the mistake of speaking out too powerfully against Antony, and in the new round of mass murder, that was the triumvirate's main achievement. His name featured among those of hundreds of other senators and knights on the dreaded lists. A special hit squad was sent for him in December 43 BCE, and they cut off his head as he was being carried in a litter away from one of his country properties in a hopeless attempt to go to ground. Hopeless partly because one of the family's ex-slaves had leaked his whereabouts. It was another symbolic finale to the Roman Republic, and discussed for centuries afterwards. In fact, Cicero's last moments were endlessly replayed in Rome's oratorical training schools, where the question of whether he should have begged Antony for mercy, or even trickier, have offered to destroy all his writing in return for his life, was a favourite debating topic on the curriculum. In reality, the sequel was more sordid. His head and right hand were sent to Rome and pinned up on the rostra in the Forum. Antony's wife, Fulvia, who had once been married to Cicero's other great enemy, Clodius, came to view the trophy. The story was that, in her gloating, she took the head down, spat on it, and pulled out and pierced the tongue over and over with pins she removed from her hair. Any fragile truce was now forgotten. In October 42 BCE, the united forces of the Triumvirate defeated Brutus and Cassius near the town of Philippi in the far north of Greece, the focus of much of Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and the victorious allies then began, even more systematically, to turn on one another. In fact, when Octavian returned from Philippi to Italy to oversee a massive programme of land confiscation, aimed at providing settlement packages for thousands of dangerously dissatisfied retiring soldiers, he soon found himself facing the armed opposition of Fulvia and Mark Antony's brother, Lucius Antonius. They had taken up the cause of the landowners who had been dispossessed and even managed to gain control of the city of Rome, albeit briefly. Octavian soon had them under siege in the town of Perusia, modern Perugia. Starvation forced their surrender early in 40 BCE, but the stage had been set for more than a decade of further war, interspersed with brief truces between the different parties who claimed to represent Caesar's legacy. It is often hard to make much coherent sense of the shifting coalitions and changing aims of the various players in the different rounds of this conflict. It remains anyone's guess what combination of indecision, political realignment and self-interest caused Cicero's one-time son-in-law, Dolabella, to change sides twice within a few months, before taking a command against the liberators in the east, tricking, torturing and executing the unfortunate governor of Asia en route, and meeting his own death in 43 BCE, as he tried unsuccessfully to confront Cassius in Syria. Will anyone ever have the talent to put this all in writing so that it seems like fact, not fiction? One later Roman author asked, clearly expecting the answer, no. Yet, confusing as the roles of many of the leading characters are, this conflict offers more evidence than any before in Roman history of what this kind of war meant for the rest of the population of Italy, soldier and civilian, including the real or scripted voices of some of the innocent victims. The poor peasants, who lost their land in confiscations of the Triumvirate, are a focus of the poet Virgil's first major work, the Eclogues, Selections. Though he was later one of the poet laureates of the Augustan regime, in the late 40s and early 30s BCE, he shone the spotlight on the fallout of civil war in the once idyllic and innocent lives of the shepherds and herdsmen of rural Italy, with Octavian a powerful and sometimes menacing figure in the background. As they sing of life and loves in their pastoral world, some of his rustic characters turn out to be the disgruntled victims of expropriation. "Some godless and ungrateful soldier will take over my carefully tended fields," one complains. "See where civil strife has brought us poor citizens." Other writers concentrated on the human side of the proscriptions, in a series of stories about clever hiding places pitiful suicides, and the brave loyalty or cruel treachery of friends, family, and slaves. One ingenious wife saved her husband by bundling him into a laundry bag. Another pushed hers into a sewer, where the foul smell successfully deterred would-be murderers. One pair of brothers apparently took refuge in a large oven until their slaves discovered them and killed one of them instantly, a revenge for his cruelty, we are meant to assume, while the other escaped, only to have his death leap into the Tiber foiled by some kindly fisherman who mistook his jump for an accidental fall and hauled him out. There is almost certainly some embellishment and added heroism in these literary accounts. But they are not so different from the description of the conduct of one loyal wife, as it is plainly inscribed on her epitaph. This explains how she went in person to Lepidus to beg for her husband's life, and came away having been roughly handled, black and blue, as if she were a slave, as the text puts it. An indication not only of the woman's bravery, but also of the almost automatic connection between slavery and corporal punishment. There is some hint of what the rank-and-file soldiers might have been thinking, too. In and around the modern town of Perugia, dozens of small sling bullets have been unearthed, deadly lead projectiles. "You're famished and pretending not to be," reads one message, lobbed into the city, where starvation eventually led to surrender. Several others carry brutally obscene messages, aimed at predictable parts of the anatomy of their different targets, male and female. "Lucius Antonius, you baldy, and you too, Fulvia, open your arsehole. I'm going for Madame Octavius's arsehole, or I'm going for Fulvia's clitoris." Landica, the earliest attested use of the term in Latin. The unsettling overlap of military and sexual violence, plus the standard Roman potshot at a receding hairline, is probably typical of the ribaldry found on the legionary front line, part bravado, part aggression, part misogyny, part ill-concealed fear. Lucius Antonius and Fulvia admitted defeat in early 40 BCE. How far she had been in joint military command is doubtful, for one of the easiest ways for the other side to attack Lucius, as they later attacked his brother, was to pretend that he was sharing command with a mere woman. In any case, Fulvia returned to Mark Antony in Greece and almost immediately died. For a while the triumvirate was patched up, and as a pledge for the future, the widowed Antony married Octavian's sister, Octavia. It was, however, an empty pledge, as by this date Antony was already in the partnership that would come to define him. He was more or less living with Queen Cleopatra of Egypt, and she had just given birth to his twins. In any case, the coalition of three was soon reduced to two, when Lepidus, who had always been a junior player, was squeezed out in 36 BCE. When the final showdown came in 31 BCE, there was no doubt about the question at stake. Who was going to rule the Roman world? Was it to be Octavian or Antony, with Cleopatra at his side? Cleopatra had been in Rome when Caesar was assassinated, lodging at one of the dictator's villas on the outskirts of the city. It was the best that Roman money could buy, though probably not a patch on the luxurious surroundings of her home in Alexandria. After the Ides of March 44 BCE, she quickly packed up and returned home. "The Queen's exit does not worry me," Cicero wrote to Atticus in a transparent understatement. But she kept her finger in Roman politics for obvious and pressing reasons. She still needed outside support to shore up her position as the ruler of Egypt, and she had plenty of cash and other resources to give to anyone prepared to offer it. She first fell in with Dolabella, Cicero's one-time son-in-law, but after his death turned to Mark Antony. Their relationship has forever been written up in erotic terms, whether hopeless infatuation on Antony's part, or one of the greatest love stories in the history of the West. Passion may have been one element of it, but their partnership was underpinned by something more prosaic: military, political, and financial needs. In 40 BCE, Octavian and Antony had effectively carved up the Mediterranean world between themselves, leaving just a small patch for Lepidus. So, for much of the 30s BCE, Octavian operated in the west, dealing with any of his Roman enemies who remained at large, including the son of Pompey the Great, the main surviving link to the civil wars of the early 40s BCE, and conquering new territories across the Adriatic. Meanwhile, in the east, Antony mounted rather more high-profile campaigns against Parthia and Armenia, but with mixed success, despite the resources of Cleopatra. Reports reaching Rome hyped the luxury of the couple's life in Alexandria. Fantastic stories circulated about their decadent banquets and their notorious bet on who could stage the most expensive dinner party of all. One deeply disapproving Roman account records that Cleopatra won by providing a spread worth 10 million sesterces, almost as much as Cicero's grandest house, including the cost of a fabulous pearl which, in an act of conspicuous and entirely pointless consumption, she dissolved in vinegar and drank. Equally worrying for Roman traditionalists was the sense that Antony was beginning to treat Alexandria as if it were Rome, even to the point of celebrating the distinctively Roman ceremony of triumph there, after some minor victory in Armenia. For the sake of Cleopatra, he bestowed on the Egyptians the honourable and solemn ceremonies of his own country, as one ancient writer reported the objections. Octavian exploited these fears in a dramatic intervention in 32 BCE. Antony had divorced Octavia earlier in the year, and Octavian responded by getting his hands on Antony's will and reading up particularly incriminating selections from it to the Senate. These revealed that Antony recognised young Caesarion as Julius Caesar's son, that he was planning to leave large amounts of money to the children he had had with Cleopatra, and that he wanted to be buried in Alexandria by Cleopatra's side, even if he died in Rome. The rumour on the Roman streets was that his long-term plans were to abandon the city of Romulus and transfer the capital wholesale to Egypt. It was against this background that open war broke out. At the start of the conflict in 31 BCE, the good money would probably have been on a victory for Antony. He had considerably more troops and more cash at his disposal. But Antony and Cleopatra lost the first battle at sea, near Actium. The name just means promontory in northern Greece. And they never regained the initiative. For one of the world's decisive military engagements which drew a final line under the Roman Republic, the Battle of Actium in September 31 BCE was a rather low-key, slightly tawdry affair. Though perhaps decisive military engagements are more low-key and tawdry than we tend to imagine. Octavian's easy victory was owed to his second-in-command, Marcus Agrippa, who managed to cut off their opponent's supplies, to a handful of well-informed deserters who disclosed the enemy plans, and to Antony and Cleopatra themselves, who simply disappeared. As soon as Octavian's forces seemed to be getting the upper hand, they beat a hasty retreat from Greece to Egypt with a small detachment of ships, abandoning the rest of their soldiers and sailors, who, understandably, did not bother to go on fighting much longer. The next year, Octavian sailed to Alexandria to finish the job. In what has often been written up as a kind of tragic farce, Antony stabbed himself when he thought that Cleopatra was already dead, though he lived just long enough to discover that she was not. A week or so later, she too is said to have killed herself with the bite from a snake smuggled into her quarters in a basket of fruit. According to the official version, her motive was to deprive Octavian of her presence in his triumphal procession. "I will not be triumphed over," she is supposed to have muttered over and over again. But it may not be so simple or as Shakespearean as that. Suicide by snake bite is a hard feat to pull off, and anyway the most reliably deadly snakes would be far too hefty to conceal in even a regal fruit basket. Although Octavian publicly regretted that he had lost the prize specimen for his triumph, he may privately have thought that the queen was less troubled dead than alive. At the very least, as several modern historians have suspected, he may have facilitated her death. He certainly took no chances with Caesarion, given his supposed paternity. Now aged 16, he was killed. What was displayed in Octavian's triumph in the summer of 29 BCE was a full-scale replica of the queen at the moment of her death, and even in this form she caught the attention of the crowd. It was as if, one later historian wrote, she was there with the other prisoners. The procession was a carefully choreographed affair which took place over 3 days, ostensibly to celebrate Octavian's victories across the Adriatic, in Illyricum, and against Cleopatra at Actium and in Egypt. There was no explicit mention of Antony or any other enemy of the civil wars, and none of the gruesome images of Roman death that Julius Caesar had ill-advisedly paraded in his celebrations 15 years earlier. Yet there could have been no real doubt about who had really been defeated, or about what the consequences of Octavian's success would be. This was as much a coronation ritual as a victory parade. Losers and winners. There is more to this story of the war between Octavian and Antony than meets the eye. What survives is the self-confident, self-justifying version written by the winners, Octavian and his friends. But the feasibility of suicide by snakebite is only one aspect of the history of this period that should raise suspicions. There is also a question mark over quite how extravagantly immoral or anti-Roman the lifestyle of Cleopatra and Antony really was. The accounts that have come down to us are not complete invention. One of the sources of Plutarch's biography of Mark Antony, written 150 years after Antony's death, and full of some of the most lurid anecdotes of his life of luxury, was a descendant of a man who worked in Cleopatra's kitchens, and may well have preserved a view of the culinary style of her court from below stairs. But it is absolutely clear that, both at the time and even more so in retrospect, Augustus, as he was soon known, exploited the idea of a clash between his own deep-rooted Roman Western traditions and the Oriental excess that Antony and Cleopatra represented. In the War of Words, and in later justifications of Augustus's rise to power, it became a struggle between the virtues of Rome and the dangers and decadence of the East. The luxury of Cleopatra's court was wildly exaggerated, and relatively innocent occasions in Alexandria were twisted out of all recognition. However Antony chose to celebrate his Armenian victory in Alexandria, for example, there is no evidence, except Roman criticisms, to suggest that it was anything resembling a Roman triumph. The scant descriptions that survive suggest that it was more likely based on some ritual of the god Dionysus. And those incriminating quotations from Antony's will would certainly have been a prejudicial selection, even if not an outright invention. The Battle of Actium too played a key role in later representations. It was made out to be a much more impressive encounter than it really was, and built up to be the founding moment of the Augustan regime, which is still usually said to have begun in 31 BCE. One later historian went so far as to suggest that the 2nd of September, the exact date of the encounter, is one of the few Roman dates worth remembering. A new town called Nicopolis, Victoryville, was built near the battle site, as well as a vast monument overlooking the sea, decorated with rams from the captured ships, and a frieze depicting the triumphal procession of 29 BCE. Rome was also filled with the reminders of it, on everything from monumental sculpture to precious cameos, and many ordinary soldiers who had fought on the winning side proudly gave themselves the extra name Actiacus, or Actium Man. What is more, in the Roman imagination, the battle was almost instantly turned into a clash between solid, disciplined Roman troops and wild hordes of Orientals. Despite the fact that Antony had the staunch support of several hundred senators, all the emphasis was on the exotic rabble with, as Virgil put it, their barbarian wealth and weird weapons, and Cleopatra issuing commands by shaking an Egyptian rattle. Cleopatra was a crucial element in this whole picture. Whether or not she, like Fulvia, really played the leading part in the military command, as ancient writers claimed, is debatable. But she was a useful target. By focusing on her rather than on Antony, Octavian could present the war as one fought against a foreign rather than a Roman enemy, and led by a commander not only dangerous, regal and seductive, but also unnatural in Roman terms, in undertaking the male responsibilities of warfare and command. Antony might even seem to be her victim, enticed from the proper path of Roman duty by a foreign queen. When Virgil, in his Aeneid, written just a few years after Octavian's victory, imagines Queen Dido burning with love in her African kingdom of Carthage and attempting to seduce Aeneas from his destiny of founding Rome, there is more than a faint echo of Cleopatra. So, is it possible to reconstruct an alternative version of the story? In detail, it is not. The problem is that in this case the victor's perspective is so dominating that it is easier to be suspicious of the standard line than to replace it. There are, however, a few hints of different perspectives. It is not difficult to see what the image of Octavian would have been if Antony had won at Actium, a sadistic young thug with a dangerous tendency to self-aggrandizement. In fact, some of the worst anecdotes about his youth may go back to Antony's negative propaganda, including the story of the fancy dress banquet where Octavian impersonated the god Apollo. His biographer, Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, just Suetonius from now on, explicitly states that this combination of sacrilege and extravagance was one of the accusations that Antony levelled at him. Some people at the time were fatalistic or realistic enough to think that it would not make much difference whichever of them won. A curious anecdote about some talking ravens amusingly sums up that idea. Octavian, so the story goes, was returning to Rome after the Battle of Actium when he was met by an ordinary working man who had trained a pet raven to say, "Greetings, Caesar, our victorious commander." He was so impressed with the trick that he gave the man a substantial cash reward. But it turned out that the trainer had a partner who was not given his share of the money, and to make his point went to Octavian and suggested that the man should be asked to produce his other raven. The pair of chancers had been sensibly hedging their bets. When this second bird was brought out, it squeaked, "Greetings, Antony, our victorious commander." Happily, Octavian saw the funny side and simply insisted that the first man share the reward with his partner. Part of the point of this story was to demonstrate Octavian's human touch and his generous attitude towards a couple of harmless tricksters. But there was a political message too. A pair of identikit birds, with their almost identikit slogans, is meant to hint that there was much less to choose between Octavian and his rival than the usual partisan stories suggests. The victory of one rather than the other required no more adjustment than swapping one talking bird for another. The Riddle of Augustus. It is impossible even to guess how Antony would have ruled the Roman world if he had ever had the chance. But there is little doubt that whoever emerged as the victor after the long civil wars, the outcome was going to be not a return to Rome's traditional pattern of power-sharing, but some form of autocracy. By 43 BCE, even Brutus the Liberator was striking coins, featuring his own head, which was a fair indication of the direction in which he was moving. It was not so clear what form that one-man rule would take, or how it could be made to succeed. Octavian almost certainly did not return to Italy from Egypt with an autocratic master plan ready to apply, but through a long series of practical experiments, improvisations, false starts, a few failures, and, very soon, a new name intended to consign the bloody associations of Octavian to the past, he eventually devised a template for how to be a Roman emperor which lasted in most of its significant details for the next 200 years or so, and, in broader terms, much longer. Some of his innovations are still taken for granted as part and parcel of our mechanisms of political power. For the founding father of all Roman emperors, however, it has always proved difficult to pin him down. In fact, the new name Augustus, which he adopted soon after his return from Egypt, and which I shall use from now on, captures the slipperiness very nicely. It is a word that evoked ideas of authority, auctoritas, and proper religious observance, echoing the title of one of the main groups of Roman priests, called the augures. It sounded impressive, and had none of the unfortunate fratricidal or regal associations of Romulus, another potential name which he is said to have rejected. No one had ever been called it before, although it had occasionally been used as a rather high-flown adjective, meaning something more or less like holy. All later emperors took over Augustus as part of their title, but the truth is, it did not really mean anything. Revered One gets it about right. Even at the time of his funeral, people were debating exactly what Augustus's regime had been based on. Was it a moderate version of autocracy, founded on respect for the citizen, the rule of law, and patronage of the arts? Or was it not far short of a blood-stained tyranny under a ruthless leader who had not changed much since the years of civil war, and with a series of high-profile victims executed either for plotting against him or for getting into bed with Julia, his daughter? Whether people liked or loathed him, he was in many ways a puzzling and contradictory revolutionary. He was one of the most radical innovators Rome ever saw. He exercised such influence over elections that the popular democratic process withered. The large new building completed in 26 BCE to house the assemblies was soon more often used for gladiatorial shows than for voting, and one of the first acts of his successor was to transfer what remained of the elections to the Senate, leaving the people out entirely. He controlled the Roman army by directly hiring and firing the legionary commanders, and by making himself the overall governor of all the provinces in which there was a military presence. He attempted to micromanage the behaviour of citizens in an entirely new and intrusive way, from regulating the sex life of the upper classes, who were to suffer political penalties if they did not produce enough children, to stipulating what people should wear in the forum. Togas only. No tunics, trousers, or nice warm cloaks. And unlike anyone before, he directed the traditional mechanisms of Roman literary patronage towards a concerted, centrally sponsored campaign. Cicero had been eager to find poets to celebrate his various successes. Augustus, to all intents and purposes, had writers such as Virgil and Horace on his payroll, and the work they produced offers a memorable and eloquent image of a new golden age for Rome and its empire, with Augustus centre stage. I have given them empire without limit, imperium sine fine, Jupiter prophesies for the Romans in Virgil's Aeneid, national epic, instant classic, and a book which landed straight on the school curriculum in Augustan Rome. It still remains just on the modern Western curriculum 2,000 years later. Yet Augustus appears to have abolished nothing. The governing class remained the same. This was no revolution in the strict sense of the word. The privileges of the Senate were in many ways enhanced, not removed, and the old offices of state, consulships and praetorships and so on, continued to be coveted and filled. Much of the legislation that is usually ascribed to Augustus was formally introduced, or at least fronted, by those regular officials. It was a standing joke that the pair of consuls who proposed one of his laws promoting marriage were both bachelors. Most of his formal powers were officially voted to him by the Senate and cast almost entirely in a traditional republican format. His continued use of the title Son of a God being the only important exception. And he lived in no grand palace, but in the sort of house on the Palatine Hill, where you would expect to find a senator, and where his wife, Livia, could occasionally be spotted working her wool. The word that Romans most often used to describe his position was princeps, meaning first citizen rather than emperor, as we choose to call him. And one of his most famous watchwords was civilitas, we're all citizens together. Even where he seems most visible, Augustus turns out to be elusive, and that was presumably part of his secret. One of his most significant and lasting innovations was to flood the Roman world with his portrait. Heads stamped on the small change in people's pockets, life-size or larger statues in marble and bronze standing in public squares and temples, miniatures embossed or engraved on rings, gems, and dining room silverware. This was on a vastly bigger scale than anything of the sort before. There is no earlier Roman for whom more than a handful of possible portraits are known, and most of those are uncertainly identified anyway. The temptation to give a name to otherwise anonymous heads, or to find a face for Cicero and Brutus and so on, often proving irresistible, despite the lack of evidence. Even for Julius Caesar, apart from coins, there are only a couple of very doubtful candidates for a portrait that was made during his lifetime. By contrast, about 250 statues, not to mention images on jewels and gems, found right across Roman territories and beyond, from Spain to Turkey and Sudan, show Augustus in many different guises, from heroic conqueror to pious priest. These all have such similar facial features that standard models must have been sent out from Rome in a coordinated attempt to spread the emperor's image to his subjects. They all adopt an idealizing youthful style that echoes the classical art of 5th century BCE Athens and makes a glaring and loaded contrast with the craggy, elderly, wrinkled, exaggerated realism that is characteristic of the portraits of the Roman elite in the earlier part of the 1st century BCE. They were all intended to bring a far-flung population, most of whom would never see the man himself, face to face with their ruler. And yet, they almost certainly looked nothing like the real Augustus at all. Not only do they fail to match up with the one surviving written description of his features, which, trustworthy or not, prefers to stress his unkempt hair, his bad teeth, and the platform shoes which, like many autocrats since, he used to disguise his short stature. They also look almost exactly the same throughout his life, so that at the age of 70-plus he was still being portrayed as a perfect young man. This was, at best, an official image. To put it less flatteringly, a mask of power, and the gap between this and the flesh-and-blood emperor, the man behind the mask, has always been, for most people, impossible to bridge. Unsurprisingly, several well-informed ancient observers decided that the enigma of Augustus was the whole point. Nearly 400 years later, in the mid-4th century CE, the Emperor Julian wrote a clever skit on his predecessors, imagining them all turning up together for a grand party with the gods. They troop in, matching what had by then become their caricatures. Julius Caesar is so power-crazy that he seems likely to unseat the king of the gods and party host. Tiberius looks terribly moody. Nero cannot bear to be parted from his lyre. Augustus enters like a chameleon who is impossible to sum up, a tricky old reptile continually changing colour from yellow to red to black, one minute gloomy and sombre, the next parading all the charms of the goddess of love. The divine hosts have no option but to hand him over to a philosopher to make him wise and moderate. Earlier writers hinted that Augustus relished this kind of tease. Why else did he choose for the design of his signet ring, with which he authenticated his correspondence, the ancient equivalent of a signature, the image of the most famous riddling creature in the whole of Greco-Roman mythology, the Sphinx? Roman dissidents, who have been followed by a number of modern historians, pushed the point further, accusing the Augustan regime of being based on hypocrisy and pretense, and of abusing traditional republican forms and language to provide a cloak and disguise for a fairly hard-line tyranny. There is certainly something in this. Hypocrisy is a common weapon of power, and on many occasions it may have suited Augustus to be just as Julian painted him, enigmatic, slippery, and evasive, and to say one thing while meaning another. But that can hardly have been everything. There must have been firmer footings under the new regime than a series of riddles, doublespeak, and pretense. So what were those footings? How did Augustus get away with it? That is the problem. It is almost impossible to see behind the scenes of the Augustan regime, despite all the evidence we appear to have. This is one of the best documented periods of Roman history. There are volumes of contemporary poetry, mostly singing the emperor's praises, though not always. Ovid's hilarious spoof on how to pick up a partner, which still survives under the title Ars Amatoria, Love Lessons, was sufficiently at odds with Augustus's moral program that it was one reason for the poet ending up in exile on the Black Sea. His relationship with Julia may have been another. And any number of later historians and antiquarians found Augustus an interesting subject, whether they were reflecting on his imperial style or collecting his jokes and bon mots. The repartee with the raven trainers is only one example from a mini-anthology of his banter, which also includes some nice fatherly ribaldry on his daughter's habit of pulling out her grey hairs. Tell me, would you rather be grey or bald? Another memorable survival is the chatty, episodic biography written by Suetonius about 100 years after the emperor's death. It is the source of remarks about his teeth and hair, as well as many more reliable and unreliable snapshots and snippets, right down to his occasional poor spelling, his terror of thunderstorms, and his habit of wearing 4 tunics and a vest under his toga in the winter. Among all this, however, there is almost no good evidence, and certainly none of it contemporary, about the nuts and bolts, disputes and decision-making that underpinned the new politics of Rome. The few private letters of Augustus that Suetonius exerts were chosen for what they say about his luck on the gambling table or his lunch menu, a bit of bread and some dates in my carriage, rather than about any political strategy. Roman historians complained about almost exactly the same issue as the modern historian faces. When they tried to write the history of this period, they found that so much of importance had happened in private, rather than publicly in the Senate House or Forum as before, that it was hard to know exactly what had taken place, let alone how to explain it. What does survive, however, is the text of Augustus's Curriculum Vitae, a document that he wrote at the end of his life, summing up his achievements. Res gestae, as the surviving version is usually titled in Latin, or What I Did. It is a self-serving, partisan, and often rose-tinted piece of work, which carefully glosses or entirely ignores the murderous illegalities of his early career. It is also a unique account in roughly 10 pages of modern text, of what the old reptile wanted posterity to know about his many years as princeps, how he defined the role and how he claimed to have changed Rome. It is worth attending to his sometimes surprising words before trying to look behind them. What I did. A rare piece of archaeological good fortune has preserved this version of Augustus's life story. In his will, he asked that it be inscribed on 2 bronze pillars at the entrance to his vast family tomb, as a permanent record of what he had done, and something not far short of a job description for his successors. The original pillars have long since been melted down, probably into some form of medieval ballistics, but the text was copied on stone in other parts of the empire to memorialise his rule outside Rome too. Fragments of four of these copies have been discovered, including an almost complete version from Ankara, modern Ankara. This version has been inscribed on the walls of a temple in honour of Rome and Augustus, both in the original Latin and in a Greek translation, for the benefit of the largely Greek-speaking inhabitants of the area, and was preserved because the temple was turned into a Christian church in the 6th century CE, and then later into part of a mosque. There are all kinds of stories of heroic efforts expended from the mid-16th century onwards in deciphering and copying the emperor's words at often perulous heights, until Kemal Atatürk, as the president of Turkey, proudly had the whole inscription uncovered and preserved in the 1930s to mark the 2000th anniversary of Augustus's birth. But the simple fact that the best text of the emperor's words survives thousands of miles away, and in the ancient world more than a month's journey away from Rome, sums up a lot about the imperial regime and its public face. The Res Gestae is a rich source of detail about Augustus's career and the Roman world of his day. It starts with a delicately euphemistic description of his rise to power, which entirely omits any mention of the pogrom. "I liberated the state oppressed by the power of a faction," is how he refers to his clash with either Antony or Brutus and Cassius. It goes on to refer briefly to such things as his splendid triumphal processions. "Nine kings, or children of kings, walked as captives before his chariot," he boasts, with typical Roman delight in captured royalty, and his emergency management of the Roman corn supply when famine loomed. For some modern historians, the most important sentences are the couple that report the result of his census of Roman citizens, recording a total headcount of 4,063,000 in 28 BCE, rising to 4,937,000 in 14 CE. These are the most reliable data we have for the size of the ancient Roman citizen body at any time, largely because, inscribed on stone, they are prone to none of the errors that careless manuscript copiers can easily introduce. Even so, there is still a fierce dispute about whether the figures include men only or women and children too, whether, in other words, the Roman citizen population all told was around 5 million, allowing for some under-registration, or something over 12 million. None of this, however, was Augustus's main theme. And many other likely topics find no place at all. There is nothing about his family, apart from one reference to honours paid to two of his adopted children who died young. There is nothing about his programme of moral legislation or his attempts to increase the birth rate, though the census figures may have been intended to demonstrate success on that score, probably erroneously, as it is much more likely that the creation of new citizens and more efficient counting lay behind most of the rise in numbers, rather than imperial finger-wagging at the upper class for not producing enough babies. There is little more than allusive references to any individual piece of legislation or political reform. Instead, roughly two-thirds of the text is devoted to just three main subjects: Augustus's victories and conquests, his benefactions to the Roman people, and his buildings. More than two pages of the modern text of the Res Gestae catalogue the territories he added to the empire, the foreign rulers he made subject to Rome, and the embassies and suppliants who flocked to recognise the emperor's power. "I extended the territory of all the provinces of the Roman people, which had neighbours not obedient to our rule," he announces with slight exaggeration, before moving on to itemise, at what can now seem tedious length, his imperial successes and military victories all over the world. Egypt made a Roman possession, the Parthians forced to return the Roman military standards lost in 53 BCE, A Roman army reaching the city of Mero, south of the Sahara, and a fleet entering the North Sea. Delegations arriving from as far afield as India. Not to mention a mixed bag of renegade kings begging for mercy, with names gratifyingly exotic to a Latin ear. Ardavastes, king of the Medes, Artaxerxes of the Adiabenians, Dumnobaranus and Tincomarus of the Britons. And that is only a small slice of it. There is something entirely traditional about this. Military success has been one foundation of political power as far back in Roman history as it is possible to go. Augustus outstripped all possible rivals on this score, bringing more territory under Roman rule than anyone else before or after. Yet this was a new kind of imperialism too. The heading of the inscribed text, the closest thing it has to an original title, reads, "This is how he made the world subject to the power of the people of Rome." Pompey, more than half a century earlier, had just hinted at that kind of ambition. Augustus explicitly turned global conquest and a joined-up territorial view of an empire centred on Rome, rather than the old mosaic of obedient states, into a rationale for his rule. How all this would have come across to the provincial audience in Ankara is impossible to know, but it is an idea reflected in other monuments that Augustus sponsored in the city of Rome, most famously in the world map that he and his colleague Marcus Agrippa commissioned and put on public display. No trace of this survives, and the best guess is that it was something closer to an annotated plan of Roman roads than a realistic geography in our terms. But whatever its exact appearance, it fitted Augustus's vision of empire. As Pliny later put it in his encyclopedia, the map's purpose was to make the world, orbis, something for the city, urbs, to see or to display the world as Roman territory under the emperor's rule. Augustus's generosity to the ordinary people at home claims as much space in the res gestae as his conquests abroad. He was wealthy on a new scale. The combination of his inheritance from Caesar, the riches of Egypt that he seized after the defeat of Antony and Cleopatra, and the occasional blurring of the boundary between state funds and his own, meant that he could outbid anyone as a popular benefactor. Here he carefully lists his regular distributions of cash, the dates, the precise amounts he gave per head, often the equivalent of several months' pay for an ordinary worker, and the number of beneficiaries. "These handouts of mine never reached fewer than 250,000 men," he insists. He also catalogues other kinds of gifts and sponsorship. These were above all gladiatorial shows, athletic spectacles, wild beast hunts with animals specially imported from Africa. A later writer refers to 420 leopards on a single occasion, and one mock naval battle that became legendary. This was a huge triumph of engineering and ingenuity, for it was staged, as Augustus proudly explains, on an artificial lake, more than 500 metres by 350, specially constructed on the other side of the Tiber, in modern Trastevere, and it featured 30 large warships, plus even more smaller boats, and 3,000 fighting men in addition to the rowers. On his own reckoning, the Roman people could have counted on roughly one major entertainment at the emperor's expense each year. It was hardly the daily bloodbath of popular pleasure that the modern movie image of ancient Rome suggests, but it still involved a vast outlay of time, logistics and cash, as well as human and animal lives. The message is clear. It was an axiom of the Augustan regime that the emperor paraded his generosity to the ordinary people of the city of Rome, and that they, in turn, were to look to him as their patron, protector, and benefactor. He made the same point when he took, or technically was given,